Accession number 27226, reel 29.
Hook, reel 29.
Right. Well, I've now got some contacts with civilization with NCS 54. Now, I'm supposed to go to Cox's Bazaar, and these boys are gunboats, and they go down past Cox's Bazaar every night and twice on Sundays to see what they can do and go up the chongs and fire at people and generally make a nuisance of themselves. And if I'd have known when I'd arrived and gone straight down there, I could have got on one of their boats and been taken down and dropped ashore. Whether they would have wanted me in the middle of the night at Cox's, I don't know, dressed as I was, but that's a sort of concept. And I was bitten to buggery. Really, I'd never been bitten so badly with all the things that got at me in that in the Kedda. But then the SNO did his big thing, and a jeep arrived with this big Indian driver and the bloke with the gun, and to take me down to Cox's Bazaar. Now, Cox's Bazaar has a one-way system of short road because lorries couldn't pass on the road. I don't know why, but I did it later on, but I can't remember much about it. Never mind. We're down to go with a jeep, which is my personal property, back to Cox's Bazaar, and I can't get down the road. So we come back. I said to the boys, I said, take me to the airfield, Gildy Gildy, which I understand means go fast, because I thought if I go to the airfield, there's somebody there and have an airplane, I can borrow one or something, and I can get down to Cox's Bazaar where they have an airfield anyway. We nearly killed Mountbatten and Arthur Power on the way round because he was addressing the troops. Because by the time I'd had a night's sleep and found the Kenner and everything else, the reason for Arthur Power going over there and McLewis flying over became apparent. They were having a meeting with all the bigwigs, and they were inspecting the troops, you know. And this bloody Indian was on the airfield, and this driver was going to take me urgently to catch an aeroplane. We nearly wiped the whole bloody lot out. Oh dear, that was hairy. And, God bless him, Arthur Power knew who it was. He was the only person who could recognise it. He never said a word, never cried, Cook. So, here we have now a situation where I've got a jeep, I've got two troops who know where Cox's Bazaar is, and I'm looking for an aeroplane. And there wasn't one already. So I said, well, I'll get one. You go back, and I'll be down to see you later on. I got an aeroplane. A DC-3 was going down. But I had to wait a long time. By the time I got there, they'd broken the myth of the road, and they got on the road and gone down. And they were there. They got a tent. They set out for me. A ground sheet in the front, dug a hole in the ground with water and everything else, shaving tackle, everything I needed to go there. So I flew down, got to Cox's, went in, had I was sitting in this bath having a washing down, and suddenly there was gunfire and bangs and shooting. I thought, Jesus, where the hell am I? I didn't come for this. And then it all quietened down. There was a lot of shouting and bawling. And the Japanese got into the planning area where we were living, which I'll describe in a minute. And they killed him alongside a field kitchen, about 50 yards. And I mean, I'd only been there 10 minutes. I wasn't very impressed with that, I tell you. Anyway, I settled down, found out where the food was. And it was probably routine. It was probably in a big tent somewhere. One of the tents was big as a... I don't remember. They were getting towards Christmas now. And the dates and times become relevant in this context. But I went into the mess and made my number and had a meal. Had a good night's sleep. And the next day, I had to go into the planning department to find out what's going on. And they're all pongos. And... I was in there and two things happened. And let's get the sequence right. It must have been... Let me see. Stop it a minute. I settled down in the place, and I had to go and look for airfields. That was the first thing that happened. And so the thing is quite interesting, and a lot of bits and pieces in it. And so I had a meal, I washed and polished and everything else, and I told the boys to drive to an airfield further down to see what it was like. And it was only when I got there I realised that we couldn't use any airfields in Burma, because the simple reason, it was fatal. They were all made of mesh. None of them, there was no hardcore airfield except the main one where they had this metal grids, you know, the metal plates. I said, we can't use any of them because they're all, you know, wire meshing, and if the boys coming into land, they get down automatically, they put a hook down. And the first one that come and would take away the airfield, and the rest of right in the airfield, it wasn't any good anymore. So that was that. There was a no-no as far as airfield was concerned. I had occasion, I believe in that time scale, I met an air commodore telling him what I was there for, we didn't get any further. Because I said, well, I knew by then that Cox's Bazaar was on a beach. And the beach itself, we could see Brennan carriers running up and down it. I said, we don't need any airfield, we'll just land on the beach. And so I said, as far as I'm concerned, we'll land on the beach. All we want is an Erk and some petrol, ring back Calcutta and send somebody down, and that'll be okay. So that was really, in 24 hours, that solved the problem, as far as I was concerned, that we could land on the beach, the best possible place we could land, because it was clear, it was long, it was 26 miles long anyway, and all we needed was the troops to refuel and everything else, because it would have to be lifted. It was all, you know, but that didn't matter.
Would the sand have been compact enough?
Oh yes, it was all mud. It was a mixture of mud and sand, and it was washed every day, and it was very, very sound. I mean, Bren gun carriers were working backwards and forward all the time on the beach, because it was the quickest way to communicate with them. It was just the facts of life of Burma, which I was learning rather quickly. Anyway, I went back to the planners and told them what was about. I said, we don't need airfield, we can land on the beaches, we don't want any Bren gun carriers rushing around when there's people landing, but apart from that there's no problem. And it didn't really matter, because the thing was, the beach ran north and south, and the winds were almost consistent the same way any time, so they could land with a crosswind, and there was space. It was okay. And I was in there minding my own business, and I said, well, we don't need any more airfield, and I was just looking at what was what. And the boys were talking, and said, well, you want to start for a hook? I said, do you know anything about mangrove swamps? I said, well, not a lot, but I said, our airfield was in the middle of one. He said, well, we're looking at this, and there's a beach here. Do you think we could get through that mangrove swamp to get to the mainland if we land down the Chong? I know I can get the mental picture of that. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, it looks okay to me. But I was doing nothing then. I finished my work, you know, in about one or two days. I said, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go and see if I can borrow an aeroplane from the Americans, and I'll pop down and have a look. Oh, okay, they said. So I went along to see the American, they were Kazivaks, and there were a lot of conscientious objectors from America who wouldn't fly combat, but they would fly nursing services, and they flew sentinels, sentinels, and they'd been modified to take a stretcher in the back, take one person. And I was also on the same airfield where the RAF was doing the same thing, and they converted tiger moths. and they'd taken the backs of Tiger Moths off and made a lid in the top and put the stretchers inside there and closed the whole lot down. And I didn't fancy going in a Tiger Moth, but I'd flown Sentinels, and I thought the Sentinel would be okay, so I borrowed a Sentinel. And I went down to the airfield at Akiab, and I went down there. There was nothing fancy or brave about it at all, because it was a light aircraft, and nobody could shoot me down on that one, because I'd just hit go down on the water, and then they'd go in if they tried to do me any damage, and I could turn on the 6 months. So that was no problem. But I went down to have a look at the Chang. I thought I'd have a look at this. And I looked up there, and nobody told me until years afterwards that you don't fly over rivers low in Burma, because the Japanese had wired them. They put a wire across the river so that if you're flying low, you made a mess of yourself. But they didn't tell me. And I used to like flying over water and things, but it's always the safest place because it was clean and, you know, it was, I don't know, anyway. And I went down and had a look at this place, and it was all right. It was a nice wide beach and it looked quite solid. And I thought, well, I'm here. I might as well pop and have a look at the airfield at Akiab and see what's going on there. No for no, but a stupid thing to do, really. But I was there and I was flying and, you know, sort of nosy, really. And I flew over the airfield at Akiab, which was the main reason for Akiab Island. We wanted the airfield. And there was nothing there. There was absolutely nothing on the airfield at all. No people, no cars, no trucks, no airplanes, bugger all. And I flew over it, and there was no life whatsoever, nothing. And I thought, oh, a bit odd, but there's nothing there. So I flew back. I went up the beach, and flew back up the beach, went back into plans. And I said, oh, I've had a look at your beach, and that's fine. I said, but there's nobody there. There's absolutely nothing in the airfield at China Bay, at Akiab. Oh, bullshit, they said. But they rang up Calcutta and sent a PIU spit down to have a look. And I know this because I was confirmed by somebody who was in Calcutta who knew about it. So all these stories I tell have been confirmed by people who were miles away. They sent the PIU spit over, he flew over, they said there's nothing there. And they cancelled the whole of that operation at Akiab. The whole bloody lot, sitting in China Bay, and there was all cruisers and the bloody lot, completely cancelled. So, there am I now, down there. They've cancelled the thing, and they say, well, you can go home. What a good idea. And I'm still in plans, and I'm seeing the things that we're bringing down. They're bringing a lot of boats for
landing craft.
And my brother-in-law was the chief engineer on the only heavy lift ship that could handle landing crafts, and it was coming into Chittagong. So I went back up to Chittagong. I was staying there. Now, I left Cox's Bazaar completely. And I must have been staying in the Kedah. I don't remember that anyway, but it doesn't matter. I'm back in Chittagong now, knowing that my brother-in-law is coming in to Chittagong any minute. And so I stayed there, and it was due. It must have been due in a short, very short timescale from Chittas. And I waited, and he sailed in. And I went out to the ship when he dropped the anchor, and I went on board his ship with the pilot, and I went on board, and I'm dressed funny, you know, I'm odd. I went on board this ship, and I said, could I speak to Chief Engineer Thurtle, please? And he said, yes, sir. He did say sir, which is knew I was something. And he went down to the inside, and I could hear him. He shouted down, Chiefy Circle, he said, there's a silly bugger up here on the decks wants to see you. Don't know what he wants, though. And my brother-in-law came up on the deck. And who would know? How could it be possible? The ship, it's a secret ship. Nobody knows about it. It's coming into Chittagong. People only know it's a ship coming into Chittagong. With all these, maybe with the landing craft on there. S.N. Oman will know. But nobody else would know that my brother-in-law was the chief engineer of it. And you can imagine, he was gobsmacked. Well, it was coming up to Christmas. I had Christmas dinner at Cox's Bazaar. So I've left Cox's Bazaar. So I'd obviously come back to Chittagong to be there to meet my brother. And I met him. And I had Christmas dinner on board his ship. Again. And that was pleasant because I'd seen it and seen that lot. And now I'd left Cox's Bazaar. And there, I had to go. While I was there for more than just two or three days. I was there over Christmas. And so that's, I can tell from a logbook where it was. But one thing I did that with Lomax, Brigadier Lomax, was that it were quite friendly. And he used to go on his instead of going down the road, he used to go on his Bren gun carrier along the beach to the point, and then to get from there you had to come inland to get back onto the road, or you could go out to sea round a point and come back the other tide. And one day he was there waiting for his car to take him or something. And I said, well, if you've got the jeep there, down at we have a landing craft here at the bottom end. If you want to get there quickly, you can drive up in your jeep or Bren or whatever like that. Stay here. You can go around and land across the corner and get a car there, and you're away. You'll save yourself half a day. And yes, he did. And so we set him up that way. So we had a little routine. Because the beach, you see, I was interested in the beach because the way it wore in it. And we had fun and games. We had the story of the Christmas Day at Cox's Bazaar was interesting because at a football match where there was a destroyer out in the bay, and that came ashore to play football with the boys. And of course, Christmas Day being what it was, everybody had pissed out of the miles anyway. And two aircraft came in to land for a bit of a jolly, I think, on the beach. And they came in to land, and one landed further up. And I think that was the one that landed. I think the first one tried to land on the cricket, on the football pitch. And he went round, and the other bloke came in and landed further up, and they came further up the beach and landed, and they joined in the frivolities. And the Lieutenant Colonel there, who is again, he got in a brand gun carrier and drove it across the football pitch while they were playing. It was real mayhem. And then he fell asleep driving the damn thing, and it went rolling down the beach until it ended amongst some rocks further down. It was a real chaotic Christmas, and they made a Christmas punch. I always remember that. It was made in an enamel bowl, and they poured everything into it that was drinkable, and they heated it up as a punch. And it was in this enamel bowl, and they had candles or night little candles underneath to keep it hot. The things they did down there. Oh, they made a Christmas tree with stuff from the cigarette packets and batteries and torchlights and everything else, and lit it up that way. They were very clever, they were very adaptable, and it was and Christmas was quite an interesting time there, really. The food, we had a good food, and a little story about that, which is rather sad, that of course people out there, they still have to be paid. First of all, the Salvation Army were working down there, and we could always get a cup of tea. And there was the Salvation Army How they managed to do it, I don't know, but wherever it was, the going was hot, they could always be there with a cup of tea and a bun. And they were there. And there was an RAF squadron leader who used to come round, and this happened after Christmas when I was not there, to come round to pay everybody with money. He was the pay bob. And a little further away from where we were in the, I mean, we were in a very specialised area. It was very, two rings. We lived in one ring, and then inside nobody could go except the people who were in the plans. And, but away from us, and it was not very far, was a nursing unit of some sort of kind. And he had to go and pay these girls as well. Now, this is not a positive story that I was told by somebody later on. And after I left, the Japanese were still around there, because I went across with my jeep looking for airfields in areas where there were Japanese. And I didn't bloody well know. I mean, if I'd known, I wouldn't have gone. No question about that. But it was a free running do. And they were at the stage where they were disorganised, and the Japanese were themselves fighting alone, and that was this bloke who was killed in the, you know, when I arrived there. There were oddballs going around doing their own thing. And I went out there. I didn't ever see this nursing place at all. It wasn't on my itinerary somehow. But 2 days after Christmas Day, the Japanese found it and wiped the whole lot out, and the pay bob missed it. He'd done the pay and had come back.
Can you describe to me then at Cox's Bazaar, you said two rings, were they defensive?
Oh, no, it was really that was where the planning people were for Akiab and Ramri, the army people in the main. And the RAF, we didn't see many RAF in that area, but there must have been some representatives. But I can't remember there being any. There were mainly, there were Marines there. There had some Marines there, because these are the boys I was talking to. And but that was a little area that you had to go through a sentry. It was guarded, that one. And then there's another ring on the outside. I don't remember very much about it, but there's like two concentric rings. You lived in that one, you worked in that one, and then when you went inside, it was all very hush-hush, and nobody did anything about it. And it was all in a big tent. All the operations were all worked in a big tent. That was all, nothing else.
And what about, is there an actual place as Cox's Bazaar? Was it a native town? Or?
Cox's Bazaar was a bazaar. It was a focal point in the old Burma. Well, it was. We're not in Burma anyway. We're not really in Burma at all. And it was a trading post known as Cox's Bazaar, where people went to. And it was. And to give you, did I tell you about the Hindus in the in East Africa? Well, it was typically there. You see, the Indians would go with their family, and where there were native people, and set up a little shop, a little store. And that, I don't know the story of Cox's Bazaar, but that's probably what happened a long time before we ever came on the scene. But it was a trading point, it was a focal point in that part of the world. So much so, of course, that, you know, that's where the services picked it up. And don't forget, the war had changed a lot. They got out of the box at Kohima, and life was much easier because the Japs had been beaten and they were moving back, and they were fighting all over the place. It was still going on, but we didn't realise that they were pulling back. That was a big problem. They pulled out of Akiab. That's when I found it, you know.
And when you did find that Akiab, was that really your role finished then?
Yes.
That's what you've been brought specifically
for? That exercise was done. I stopped the war. I stopped that war. No question.
So when you moved back to Chittagong, were you moving had you filled your role and you'd gone back and then you met your brother-in-law?
That's right. I went to Chittagong to go down. The planners, and I can only comment on this, but I went to Chittagong to go to Cox's Bazaar, period, to make certain that we had airfields for the aircraft that were landing. Nothing else. That was my sole job. And when that was over, and that would be over when we got Akiab, I would go home. And it could have lasted a day, it could have lasted a couple of months, it could have been any time. And if it had lasted a couple of months, she wouldn't have been there when I come back, she would have been pissed off, I think, but never mind. Anyway, that was all right. But my job was very, very simple, really. I was there to go to planning for Akiab to make certain that we had airfields, period. That was my sole job. After that, I had nothing else at all. But I had to go and talk to people, find it, make arrangements, and I just said what I wanted, and people did that from then onwards. I mean, I'd say to Lomax, you know, well, that's what we want. We want some oil and fuel and petrol and the Irks, and they would ring up Calcutta and they'd be coming down, you know?
So you returned back to Chittagong once your job was completed, did you?
Yeah, because that's where the aeroplanes went from, you see. That's it. They had all the aeroplanes there at Chitters.
So what was the next stage after that, then?
Well, I was... I'd gone back. I've really dealt with that part of the world. I went back to see my brother, and I was trying to find a way home. I had to go back. And there's aeroplanes, and there's people and everything else. And I went up to... I flew to... away from Cox's Bazaar to another airfield where they had super forts, and I got into a super fort, but I was sitting around waiting for an aircraft, and then it wasn't Dum Dum, it might have been Dum Dum in near Calcutta, but I'd nothing doing. I couldn't get an airplane to get back to Colombo. And there wasn't any airplanes back, otherwise I probably would have taken one there instead of taking the ship from Colombo. But I remember going back up there, and there was a group of English paratroopers and a group of Americans at this particular airfield. And I remember the difference in the psychology of those people, particularly that the lads were all kicking the ball around, all playing around, fooling around, and they actually just sitting down smoking. Maybe they'd done some more, they weren't very happy, but basically the difference between the two groups, I remember that very well. And what I was doing on that airfield, I don't know, but that wasn't an airfield that had the super forts. But I did... I was running free, you see. I was going back and sort of get back, go home, find your way and everything else. Couldn't find a way back that way, so I'm going back to Colombo where I'm known and where I know people.